This is Audible.
This book is a work of fiction. Any references to historical events, real people, or real places are used fictitiously. Other names, characters, places, and events are products of the author's imagination. And any resemblance to actual events or places, or persons living or dead, is entirely coincidental. Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Bazaar of Bad Dreams by Stephen King. Read by Stephen King, Dylan Baker, Brooke Bloom, Kathleen Chalfant, Hope Davis, Santina Fontana, Peter Friedman, Holter Graham, Edward Herman, Will Patton, Thomas Sadowski, Tim Sample, Cotter Smith, Craig Wasson, Fred Weller, and Mayor Winningham.
Hi, this is Stephen King. Author's note. Some of these stories have been previously published, but that doesn't mean they were done then, or even that they're done now. Until a writer either retires or dies, the work is not finished. It can always use another polish and a few more revisions. There's also a bunch of new ones. Something else I want you to know. How glad I am, constant reader, that we're both still here. Cool, isn't it? I shoot from the hip and keep a stiff upper lip. AC/DC. Introduction. I've made some things for you, constant reader. You see them laid out before you in the moonlight. But before you look at the little handcrafted treasures I have for sale, let's talk about them for a bit, shall we? It won't take long. Here, sit down beside me. And do come a little closer. I don't bite. Except, we've known each other for a very long time. And I suspect you know that's not entirely true, is it? 1. You'd be surprised, at least I think you would be, at how many people ask me why I still write short stories. The reason is pretty simple. Writing them makes me happy because I was built to entertain. I can't play the guitar very well, and I can't tap dance at all, but I can do this, so I do. I'm a novelist by nature, I will grant you that, and I have a particular liking for the long ones that create an immersive experience for writer and reader, where the fiction has a chance to become a world that's almost real. When a long book succeeds, the writer and reader are not just having an affair, they are married. When I get a letter from a reader who says that he or she was sorry when The Stand or 11/22/63 came to an end, I feel that book has been a success. But there's something to be said for a shorter, more intense experience. It can be invigorating, sometimes even shocking, like a waltz with a stranger you will never see again, or a kiss in the dark, or a beautiful curio for sale laid out on a cheap blanket at a street bazaar. And, yes, when my stories are collected, I always feel like a street vendor, one who sells only at midnight. I spread my assortment out, inviting the reader, that's you, to come and take your pick. But I always add the proper caveat. Be careful, my dear, because some of these items are dangerous. They are the ones with bad dreams hidden inside, the ones you can't stop thinking about when sleep is slow to come and you wonder why the closet door is open when you know perfectly well that you shut it. 2. If I said I always enjoyed the strict discipline shorter works of fiction impose, I'd be lying. Short stories require a kind of acrobatic skill that takes a lot of tiresome practice. Easy reading is the product of hard writing, some teachers say, and it's true. Miscues that can be overlooked in a novel become glaringly obvious in a short story. Strict discipline is necessary. The writer has to rein in his impulse to follow certain entrancing side paths, and stick to the main route. I never feel the limitations of my talent so keenly as I do when writing short fiction. I have struggled with feelings of inadequacy, a soul-deep fear that I will be unable to bridge the gap between a great idea and the realization of that idea's potential. What it comes down to, in plain English, is that the finished product never seems quite as good as the splendid idea that rose from the subconscious one day, along with the excited thought, "Ah, man, I gotta write this right away." Sometimes the result is pretty good, though, and every once in a while, the result is even better than the original concept. I love it when that happens. The real challenge is getting into the damn thing, and I believe that's why so many would-be writers with great ideas never actually pick up the pen or start tapping away at the keys. All too often, it's like trying to start a car on a cold day. At first, the motor doesn't even crank, it only groans. But if you keep at it, and if the battery doesn't die, the engine starts, runs rough, and then smooths out. There are stories here that came in a flash of inspiration. Summer Thunder was one of those, and had to be written at once, even if it meant interrupting work on a novel. There are others, like Mile 81, that have waited their turn patiently for decades. Yet the strict focus needed to create a good short story is always the same. Writing novels is a little like playing baseball, where the game goes on for as long as it needs to, even if that means 20 innings. Writing short stories is more like playing basketball or football. You're competing against the clock as well as the other team. When it comes to writing fiction, long or short, the learning curve never ends. I may be a professional writer to the IRS when I file my tax return, but in creative terms, I'm still an amateur, still learning my craft. We all are. Every day spent writing is a learning experience and a battle to do something new. Phoning it in is not allowed. One cannot increase one's talent. That comes with the package. But it is possible to keep talent from shrinking. At least, I like to think so. And hey, I still love it. 3. So here are the goods, my dear constant reader. Tonight I'm selling a bit of everything. A monster that looks like a car, shades of Christine. A man who can kill you by writing your obituary. An e-reader that accesses parallel worlds. And that all-time favorite, the end of the human race. I like to sell this stuff when the rest of the vendors have long since gone home, when the streets are deserted and a cold rind of moon floats over the canyons of the city. That's when I like to spread my blanket and lay out my goods. That's enough talk. Perhaps you'd like to buy something now, yes? Everything you see is handcrafted, and while I love each and every item, I'm happy to sell them because I made them especially for you. Feel free to examine them, but please be careful. The best of them have teeth. August 6th, 2014. When I was 19 years old and attending the University of Maine, I'd drive from Orono to the little town of Durham, which is usually represented as Harlow in my books. I made this trip every 3 weekends or so to see my girlfriend, and, coincidentally, my mother. I drove a 61 Ford station wagon, 6 in a row for more go and 3 on the tree. If you don't know, ask your dad. The car was a hand-me-down from my brother David. I-95 was less traveled in those days and nearly deserted for long stretches once Labor Day passed and the summer people went back to their workaday lives. No cell phones either, of course. If you broke down, your choices were two. Fix it yourself or wait for some good Samaritan to stop and give you a lift to the nearest garage. During those 150-mile drives, I conceived a special horror of Mile 85, which was in the absolute nowhere between Gardner and Lewiston. I became convinced that if my old wagon did shit the bed, it would do so there. I could visualize it hunkered in the breakdown lane, lonely and abandoned. Would someone stop to make sure the driver was okay? That he was not, perchance, stretched out on the front seat, dying of a heart attack? Of course they would. Good Samaritans are everywhere, especially in the boondocks. People who live in the boonies take care of their own. But, I thought, suppose my old station wagon was an imposter, a monstrous trap for the unwary. I thought that would make a good story, and it did. I called it Mile 85. It was never rewritten, let alone published, because I lost it. Back then I was dropping acid regularly, and I lost all sorts of stuff, including, for short periods, my mind. Fast forward nearly 40 years. Although Maine's long stretch of I-95 is more heavily traveled in the 21st century, traffic is still light after Labor Day, and budget cuts have forced the state to close many of the rest areas. The combined gas station and Burger King, where I consume many Whoppers, near the Lewiston exit was one of those shut down. It stood abandoned, growing sadder and seedier behind the do-not-enter barriers marking its entrance and exit ramps. Hard winters had buckled the parking lot and weeds had sprouted through the cracks. One day, as I passed it, I recalled my old lost story and decided to write it again. Because the abandoned rest area was a little farther south than the dreaded Mile 85, I had to change the title. Everything else is pretty much the same, I think. That turnpike oasis may be gone, as are the old Ford wagon, my old girlfriend, and many of my old bad habits. But the story remains. It's one of my favorites.
Mile 81. Read by Thomas Sadowski.
1. Pete Simmons, 07 Huffy.
You can't come, his older brother said.
George spoke in a low voice, even though the rest of his friends, a neighborhood group of 12 and 13-year-olds who styled themselves the Rip-Ass Raiders, were up at the end of the block waiting for him. Not very patiently.
It's too dangerous.
Pete said,
I'm not afraid.
He spoke stoutly enough, although he was afraid, a little. George and his friends were headed up to the sand pit behind the bowling alley. There they'd play a game Normie Terrio had invented. Normie was the leader of the Rip-Ass Raiders, and the game was called Paratroops from Hell. There was a rutted track leading up to the edge of the gravel pit, and the game was to ride your bike along it at full speed, yelling Raiders rule at the top of your lungs and bailing from the seat of your bike as you went over. The usual drop was 10 feet or so, and the approved landing area was soft, but sooner or later someone would land on gravel instead of sand and probably break an arm or an ankle. Even Pete knew that, although he sort of understood why it added to the attraction. Then the parents would find out, and that would be the end of Paratroops from Hell. For now, however, the game, played without helmets, of course, continued. George knew better than to allow his brother to play, however. He was supposed to be taking care of Pete while their parents were at work. If Pete wrecked his Huffy at the gravel pit, George would likely be grounded for a week. If his little brother broke an arm, it would be for a month. And if, God forbid, it was his neck, George guessed he might be whiling away the hours in his bedroom until he went to college. Besides, he loved the little cock knocker.
Just hang out here, George said. We'll be back in a couple of hours.
Hang out with who? Pete asked morosely. It was spring vacation, and all of his friends, the ones his mother would have called age-appropriate, seemed to be somewhere else. A couple of them had gone to Disney World in Orlando, and when Pete thought of this, his heart filled with envy and jealousy. A vile brew, but strangely tasty.
Just hang out, George said. Go to the store or something.
He scrounged in his pocket and came out with 2 crumpled Washingtons.
Here's a couple of bucks.
Pete looked at them. Geez, I'll buy a Corvette, maybe 2.
Hurry up, Simmons, or we'll go without you,
Normie yelled.
Coming,
George shouted back, then low to Pete. Take the money and don't be a booger snot. Pete took the money.
I even brought my magnifying glass, he said. I was gonna show 'em.
They've all seen that baby trick 1,000 times, George said. but when he saw the corners of Pete's mouth tucked down, he tried to soften the blow. Besides, look at the sky, Numbo. You can't start fires with a magnifying glass on a cloudy day. Hang out. We'll play computer battleship or something when I come back.
Okay, chick shit, see you later,
Norma yelled. I gotta go, George said. Do me a favor and don't get in trouble. Stay in the neighborhood.
You'll probably break your spine and be fucking paralyzed for life, Pete said, then hastily spat between his forked fingers to take the curse off.
Good luck, he shouted after his brother.
Jump the farthest.
George waved one hand in acknowledgement, but didn't look back. He stood on the pedals of his own bike, a big old Schwinn that Pete admired but couldn't ride. He'd tried once and wiped out halfway down the driveway. Pete watched him put on speed as he raced up this block of suburban houses in Auburn, catching up with his homies. Then Pete was alone. He took his magnifying glass out of his saddlebag and held it over his forearm, but there was no spot of light and no heat. He looked glumly up at the low-hanging clouds and put the glass back. It was a good one, a rich fourth. He'd gotten it last Christmas to help with his ant farm science project. It'll wind up in the garage gathering dust, his father had said. But although the ant farm project had concluded in February, Pete and his partner, Tammy Witham, had gotten an A. Pete hadn't tired of the magnifying glass yet. He particularly enjoyed charring holes in pieces of paper in the backyard. But not today. Today the afternoon stretched ahead like a desert. He could go home and watch TV, but his father had put a block on all the interesting channels when he discovered George had been DVRing Boardwalk Empire, which was full of gangsters and bare titties. There was a similar block on Pete's computer, and he hadn't figured a workaround yet, although he would. It was only a matter of time. So what? He said in a low voice, and began to pedal slowly towards the end of Murphy Street. So fucking what? Too little to play paratroops from hell because it was too dangerous. How sucky. He wished he could think of something that would show George and Normie and all of the raiders that even little kids could face Dane. Then it came to him. He could explore the abandoned rest area. Pete didn't think the big kids knew about it because it was a kid Pete's own age, Craig Gagnon, who had told him about it. He said he'd been up there with a couple of other kids, 10-year-olds, last fall. Of course, the whole thing might have been a lie, but Pete didn't think so. Craig had given too many details, and he wasn't a particularly imaginative boy. With a destination in mind, Pete began to pedal faster. At the end of Murphy Street, he banked left onto Hyacinth. There was no one on the sidewalk, and no cars. He heard the whine of a vacuum cleaner from the Rossignols, but otherwise, everyone might have been sleeping or dead. Pete supposed they were actually at work, like his own parents. He swept right onto Rosewood Terrace, passing a yellow sign reading Dead End. There were only a dozen or so houses on Rosewood. At the end of the street was a chain-link fence. Beyond it was a thick tangle of shrubbery and scraggly second-growth trees. As Pete drew closer to the chain-link and the totally unnecessary sign mounted on it reading Not a Through Street, he stopped pedaling and coasted. He understood, vaguely, that although he thought of George and his raider pals as big kids, and certainly that was how the raiders thought of themselves, they weren't really big kids. The true big kids were badass teenagers who had driver's licenses and girlfriends. True big kids went to high school. They liked to drink, smoke pot, listen to heavy metal or hip-hop, and suck major face with their girlfriends. Hence the abandoned rest area. Pete got off his huffy and looked around to see if he was being observed. There was nobody. Even the annoying Crosskill twins who liked to jump rope, in tandem, all over the neighborhood when there was no school were not in evidence. A bald-ass miracle in Pete's opinion. Not too far away, Pete could hear the steady whoosh, whoosh, whoosh of cars on I-95 headed south to Portland or north to Augusta. Even if Craig was telling the truth, they probably fixed the fence, Pete thought. That's the way today's going. But when he bent close, he could see that although the fence looked whole, it really wasn't. Someone, probably a big kid who had long since joined the ranks of young adults, had clipped the links in a straight line from top to bottom. Pete took another look around, then laced his hands in the metal diamonds and pushed. He expected resistance, but there was none. The cut piece of chain link swung open like a farmyard gate. The really big kids had been using it, all right. Booyah. It stood to reason when you thought about it. Maybe they had driver's licenses, but the entrance and exit to the Mile 81 rest area were now blocked off by those big orange barrels the highway crews used. Grass was growing up through the crumbling pavement in the deserted parking lot. Pete had seen this for himself thousands of times because the school bus used I-95 to go the three exits from Laurelwood, where he got picked up, to Sabattis Street, home to Auburn Elementary School No. 3. He could remember when the rest area had still been open. There had been a gas station, a Burger King, a TCBY, and a Sbarro's. Then it got closed down. Pete's dad said there were too many of those rest areas on the turnpike and the state couldn't afford to keep them all open. Pete rolled his bike through the gap in the chain link and then carefully pushed the makeshift gate back until the diamond shapes matched up and the fence looked whole again. He walked toward the wall of bushes, being careful not to run the Huffy's tires over any broken glass. There was a lot of it on this side of the fence. He began looking for what he knew must be here. The cut fence said it had to be. And there it was, marked by stamped cigarette butts and a few discarded beer and soda bottles. A path leading deeper into the undergrowth. Still pushing his bike, Pete followed it. The high bushes swallowed him up. Behind him, Rosewood Terrace dreamed through another overcast spring day. It was as if Pete Simmons had never been there at all. The path between the chain link fence and the Mile 81 rest area was, by Pete's estimation, about half a mile long, and there were big kid signposts all along the way. Half a dozen small brown bottles, two with snot-caked Coke spoons still attached, empty snack bags, a pair of lace-trimmed panties hanging from a thorn bush. It looked to Pete like they'd been there for a while, like maybe 50 years. And jackpot. A half-full bottle of pop-off vodka with a screw cap still on. After some interior debate, Pete put this into his saddlebag along with his magnifying glass, the latest issue of American Vampire, and a few double-stuff Oreos in a baggie. He pushed his bike across a sluggish little stream, and bingo boingo, here he was at the back of the rest area. There was another chain-link fence, but this one was also cut, and Pete slipped right through. The path continued through high grass to the back parking lot, where, he supposed, the delivery trucks used to pull up. Close to the building, he could see darker rectangles on the pavement where the dumpsters had been. Pete lowered the kickstand of his Huffy and parked it on one of these. His heart was thumping as he thought about what came next. Breaking and entering, Sugar Bear. You could go to jail for that. But was it breaking and entering if he found an open door or a loose board over one of the windows? He supposed it would still be entering, but was entering all by itself a crime? In his heart, he knew it was, but he guessed that without the breaking part, it wouldn't mean jail time. And after all, hadn't he come here to take a risk? Something he could brag about later to Normie and George and the other rip-ass raiders? And okay, he was scared, but at least he wasn't bored anymore. He tried the door with the fading employees-only sign on it and found it not only locked, but seriously locked. No give at all. There were two windows beside it, but he could tell just by looking that they were boarded down tight. Then he remembered the chain-link fence that looked whole but wasn't, and tested the boards anyway. No good. In a way, it was a relief. He could be off the hook if he wanted to be. Only, the really big kids did go in there. He was sure of it. So how did they do it? From the front? In full view of the turnpike? Maybe so if they came at night, but Pete had no intention of checking it out in broad daylight. Not when any passing motorist with a cell phone could dial 911 and say, "Just thought you might like to know that there's a little kid playing Freddy fuck around at the Mile 81 rest area, you know, where the Burger King used to be." I'd rather break my arm playing Paratroops from Hell than have to call my folks from the Gray State Police Barracks. In fact, I'd rather break both arms and get my dick caught in the zipper. Well, maybe not that. He wandered toward the loading dock, and there, once again, jackpot. There were dozens of stamped-out cigarette butts at the foot of the concrete island, plus a few more of those tiny brown bottles surrounding their king, a dark green NyQuil bottle. The surface of the dock, where the big semis backed up to unload, was eye-high to Pete. But the cement was crumbling, and there were plenty of footholds for an agile kid in Chuck Taylor high tops. Pete raised his arms over his head, snagged finger holds in the dock's pitted surface, and the rest, as they say, is history. On the dock, in faded red, someone had sprayed Edward Little Rocks, Red Eddie's Rule. Not true, Pete thought. Rip-ass Raiders rule. Then he looked around from his current high perch, grinned, and said, "Actually, I rule." And standing up here above the empty back lot of the rest area, he felt that he did. For the time being, anyway. He climbed back down, just to make sure it was no problem, and then remembered the stuff in his saddlebag. Supplies, in case he decided to spend the afternoon here exploring and shit. He debated what to do, then decided to unstrap the saddlebag and take everything. Even the magnifying glass might come in handy. A vague fantasy began to form in his brain. Boy detective discovers a murder victim in a deserted rest area and solves the crime before the police even know a crime has been committed. He could see himself explaining to the drop-jawed raiders that it had actually been pretty easy. Elementary, my dear fucksticks. Bullshit, of course, but it would be fun to pretend. He lifted his bag onto the loading dock, being especially careful on account of the half-full vodka bottle, and then climbed back up. The corrugated metal door leading inside was at least 12 feet high and secured at the bottom with not one, but two humongous padlocks, but there was a human-sized door set into it. Pete tried the knob. It wouldn't turn, nor would the human-sized door open when he pushed and pulled, but there was some give. Quite a lot, actually. He looked down and saw that a wooden wedge had been pushed under the bottom of the door. A totally dope precaution if he had ever seen one. On the other hand, what more could you expect from kids who were stoned on coke and cough syrup? Pete pulled the wedge, and this time, when he tried the inset door, it creaked open. The big front windows of what had been the Burger King were covered in chicken wire instead of boards, so Pete had no trouble seeing what there was to see. All the eating tables and booths were gone from the restaurant part, and the kitchen part was just a dim hole with some wires sticking out of the walls and some of the ceiling tiles hanging down, but the place was not exactly unfurnished. In the center, surrounded by folding chairs, two old card tables had been pushed together. On this double-wide surface were half a dozen filthy tin ashtrays, several decks of greasy bicycle cards, and a caddy of poker chips. The walls were decorated with 20 or 30 magazine gatefolds. Pete inspected these with great interest. He knew about pussies, had glimpsed more than a few on HBO and CinemaSpank before his folks got wise and blocked the premium cable channels. But these were shaved pussies. Pete wasn't sure what the big deal was. To him, they looked sort of oogie. But he supposed he might get with the program when he was older. Besides, the bear titties made up for it. Bear titties were fucking awesome. In the corner, three filthy mattresses had been pushed together like the card tables, but Pete was old enough to know it wasn't poker that was played here. "Let me see your pussy," he commanded one of the hustler girls on the wall and giggled. Then he said, "Let me see your shaved pussy," and giggled harder. He sort of wished Craig Gagnon was here, even though Craig was a dweeb. They could have laughed about the shaved pussies together. He began to wander around, still snorting small carbonated bubbles of laughter. It was dank in the rest area, but not actually cold. The smell was the worst part, a combination of cigarette smoke, pot smoke, old booze, and creeping rot in the walls. Pete thought he could also smell rotting meat, probably from sandwiches purchased at Roselli's or Subway. Mounted on the wall beside the counter where people once ordered Whoppers and Whalers, Pete discovered another poster. This one was Justin Bieber. Justin's teeth had been blacked out, and someone had added a Nazi SWAT sticker tattoo to one cheek. Red ink devil horns sprouted from Justin's mop top. There were darts sticking out of his face. Magic markered on the wall above the poster was mouth, 15 points, nose, 25 points, eyes, 30 points each. Pete pulled out the darts and backed across the big empty room until he came to a black mark on the floor. Printed here was Bieber Line. Pete stood behind it and shot the 6 darts 10 or 12 times. On his last try, he got 125 points. He thought that was pretty good. He imagined George and Normie Terrio applauding. He went over to one of the mesh-covered windows, staring out at the empty concrete islands where the gas pumps used to be, and the traffic beyond. Light traffic. He supposed that when summer came, it would once more be bumper to bumper with tourists and summer people, unless his dad was right and the price of gas went to $7 a gallon and everybody stayed home. Now what? He'd played darts, he'd looked at enough shaved pussies to last him, well, maybe not a lifetime, but at least a few months. There were no murders to solve, so now what? Vodka, he decided. That was what came next. He'd try a few sips just to prove he could, and so future brags would have that vital ring of truth. Then, he supposed, he would pack up his shit and go back to Murphy Street. He would do his best to make his adventure sound interesting, thrilling, even, but in truth, this place wasn't such of a much. Just a place where the really big kids could come to play cards and make out with girls and not get wet when it rained. The booze. That was something. He took his saddlebag over to the mattresses and sat down, being careful to avoid the stains, of which there were many. He took out the vodka bottle and studied it with a certain grim fascination. At 10 going on 11, he had no particular longing to sample adult pleasures. The year before, he had hawked one of his grandfather's cigarettes and smoked it behind the 7-Eleven. Smoked half of it, anyway. Then he had leaned over and spewed his lunch between his sneakers. He had obtained an interesting but not very valuable piece of information that day. Beans and Franks didn't look great when they went into your mouth, but at least they tasted good. When they came back out, they looked fucking horrible and tasted worse. His body's instant and emphatic rejection of that American spirit suggested to him that booze would be no better and probably worse. But if he didn't drink at least some, any brag would be a lie. And his brother George had lie radar, at least when it came to Pete. I'll probably puke again, he thought, then said, good news is, I won't be the first in this dump. And that made him laugh again. He was still smiling when he unscrewed the cap and held the mouth of the bottle to his nose. Some smell, but not much. Maybe it was water instead of vodka and the smell was just a leftover. He raised the mouth of the bottle to his mouth, sort of hoping that was true and sort of hoping it wasn't. He didn't expect much and he certainly didn't want to get drunk and maybe break his neck trying to climb back down from the loading dock, but he was curious. His parents loved this stuff. Dares go first, he said for no reason at all, and took a small sip. It wasn't water, that was for sure. It tasted like hot, light oil. He swallowed, mostly in surprise. The vodka trailed heat down his throat and then exploded in his stomach. Holy Jesus, Pete yelled. Tears sprang to his eyes. He held the bottle out at arm's length, as if it had bitten him. But the heat in his stomach was already subsiding, and he felt pretty much okay. Not drunk, and not like he was going to puke, either. He tried another little sip now that he knew what to expect. Heat in the mouth, heat in the throat, and then boom in the stomach. Actually not bad. Now he felt a tingling in his arms and hands. Maybe his neck, too. Not the pins and needles sensation you got when a limb went to sleep, but more like something was waking up. Pete raised the bottle to his lips again, then lowered it. There was more to worry about than falling off the loading dock or crashing his bike on the way home. He wondered briefly if you could get arrested for drunk biking, and supposed you could. Having a few swigs of vodka so you could brag on it was one thing, but if he drank enough to get loaded, his mother and father would know when they came home. It would only take one look. Trying to act sober wouldn't help. They drank, their friends drank, and sometimes they drank too much. They would know the signs. Also, there was the dreaded hangover to consider. Pete and George had seen their mom and dad dragging around the house with red eyes and pale faces on a good many Saturday and Sunday mornings. They took vitamin pills, they told you to turn the TV down, and music was absolutely verboten.
The hangover looked like the absolute opposite of fun. Still, maybe one more sip might not hurt. Pete took a slightly larger swallow and shouted, "Zoom, we have liftoff!" This made him laugh. He felt a little lightheaded, but it was a totally pleasant feeling. Smoking, he didn't get. Drinking, he guessed he did. He got up, staggered a little, caught his balance, and laughed some more. "Jump into that fucking sand pit all you want, sugar bears," he told the empty restaurant. "I'm fucking Stinko, and fucking Stinko is better." This was very funny, and he laughed hard. Am I really Stinko? On just 3 sips? He didn't think so, but he was definitely high. No more. Enough was enough. "Drink responsibly," he told the empty restaurant and snorted. He'd hang out here for a while and wait for it to wear off. An hour should do it, maybe 2. Until 3 o'clock, say. He didn't have a wristwatch, but he'd be able to tell 3 o'clock from the chimes of St. Joseph's, which was only a mile or so away. Then he'd leave, first hiding the vodka for possible further research, and putting the wedge back under the door. His first stop when he got back to the neighborhood was going to be the 7-Eleven, where he'd buy some of that really strong teaberry gum to take the smell of booze off his breath. He'd heard kids say vodka was the thing to steal out of your parents' liquor cabinet because it had no smell, but Pete was now a wiser child than he'd been an hour ago. "Besides," he told the hollowed-out restaurant in a lecturely tone, "I bet my eyes are red, just like Dad's when he has 2 Marnie Mantinis." He paused. That wasn't quite right, but what the fuck? He gathered up the darts, went back to the Bieber line, and shot them. He missed Justin with all but one, and this struck Pete as the most hilarious thing of all. As he gathered them up, he sang a few lines of Baby, Justin's big hit from last year. He wondered if Justin could have a hit with a song called My Baby Shaves Her Pussy, and this struck him so funny that he laughed until he had to bend over with his hands on his knees. When the laughter passed, he wiped double snot hangers from his nose, flicked them onto the floor. "There goes your good restaurant rating," he thought. "Sorry, Burger King." And then trudged back to the Bieber line. He had even worse luck the second time. He wasn't seeing double or anything. He just couldn't nail the Biebe. Also, he felt a little sick after all. Not much, but he was glad he hadn't tried a 4th sip. "I would have popped my pop off," he said. He laughed, then uttered a ringing belch that burned coming up. Blech. He left the darts where they were and went back to the mattresses. He thought of using his magnifying glass to see if anything really small was crawling there, and then decided he didn't want to know. He thought about eating some of his Oreos, but he was afraid of what they might do to his stomach. It felt, let's face it, a little tender. He lay down and laced his hands behind his head. He had heard that when you got really drunk, everything started spinning around. Nothing like that was happening to him, but he wouldn't mind a little nap. Sleep it off kind of thing. But not too long. No, not too long. That would be bad. If he wasn't home when his folks came home, and if they couldn't find him, he would be in trouble. Probably George would be too for going off without him. The question was, could he wake himself up when the St. Joseph's chimes struck? Pete realized in those last few seconds of consciousness that he'd just have to hope so. Because he was going. He closed his eyes and slept in the deserted restaurant. Outside, in the southbound travel lane of I-95, a station wagon of indeterminate make and vintage appeared. It was traveling well below the posted minimum turnpike speed. A fast-moving semi came up behind it and veered into the passing lane, blatting its air horn. The station wagon, almost coasting now, veered into the entrance lane of the rest area, ignoring the big sign reading, "Closed, no services, next gas and food, 27 miles. It struck 4 of the orange barrels blocking the lane, sent them rolling, and came to a stop about 70 yards from the abandoned restaurant building. The driver's side door opened, but nobody got out. There were no, "Hey stupid, your door's open" chimes. It just hung, silently ajar.
If Pete Simmons had been watching instead of snoozing, he wouldn't have been able to see the driver. The station wagon was splattered with mud and the windshield was smeared with it, which was strange, because there had been no rain in northern New England for over a week, and the turnpike was perfectly dry. The car sat there a little distance up the entrance ramp under a cloudy April sky. The barrels it had knocked over came to a stop. The driver's door hung open like an invitation. 2. Doug Clayton, 09 Prius. Doug Clayton was an insurance man from Bangor, bound for Portland, where he had a reservation at the Sheraton Hotel. He expected to be there by 2 o'clock at the latest. That would leave plenty of time for an afternoon nap, a luxury he could rarely afford, before searching out dinner on Congress Street. Tomorrow he would present himself at the Portland Conference Center bright and early, take a name tag, and join 400 other agents in a conference called Fire, Storm, and Flood, Insuring for Disaster in the 21st Century. As he passed the mile 82 marker, Doug was closing in on his own personal disaster. But it was nothing the Portland conference would cover. His briefcase and suitcase were in the back seat. Lying in the passenger bucket was a Bible, King James Version. Doug would have no other. Doug was one of 4 lay preachers at the Church of the Holy Redeemer, and when it was his turn to preach, he liked to call his Bible the Ultimate Insurance Manual. Doug had taken Jesus Christ as his personal savior after 10 years of drinking that spanned his late teens and most of his 20s. This decade-long spree ended with a wrecked car and 30 days in the Penobscot County Jail. He'd gotten down on his knees in that smelly, coffin-sized cell on his first night there, and he had gotten down on them every night since. "Help me get better," he had prayed that first time, and every time since. It was a simple prayer that had been answered first 2-fold, then 10-fold, then 100-fold. He thought that in another few years, he'd be up to 1,000-fold, and the best thing? Heaven was waiting at the end of it all. His Bible was well-thumbed because he read it every day. He loved all the stories in it, but the one he loved best, the one he meditated on most often, was the parable of the Good Samaritan. He had preached on that passage from the Gospel of Luke several times, and the Redeemer congregation had always been generous with their praise afterward. God bless them. Doug supposed it was because the story was so personal to him. A priest had passed by the robbed and beaten traveler lying at the side of the road. So had a Levite. Then who comes along? A nasty, Jew-hating Samaritan. But that's the one who helps, nasty Jew-hater or not. He cleanses the traveler's cuts and scrapes and then binds them up. He loads the traveler on his donkey and fronts him a room at the nearest inn. So which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to him who fell among thieves? Jesus inquires of the hotshot young lawyer who asked him about the requirements for eternal life. And the hotshot, clearly not stupid, replies, "The one who shewed mercy." If Doug Clayton had a horror of anything, it was being like the Levite in that story, of refusing to help when help was needed, of passing by on the other side. So when he saw the muddy station wagon parked a little way up the entrance ramp of the deserted rest area, the downed orange barrels in front of it, the driver's door hanging ajar, he hesitated only a moment before flicking on his turn signal and pulling in. He parked behind the wagon, put on his 4-ways, and started to get out. Then he noticed that there appeared to be no license plate on the back of the station wagon, although there was so much damn mud it was hard to tell for sure. Doug took his cell phone out of the Prius's center console and made sure it was on. Being a good Samaritan was one thing. Approaching a plateless dog of a car without caution was just plain stupid. He walked towards the station wagon with the phone clasped loosely in his left hand. Nope. No plate. He was right about that. He tried to peer through the back window and could see nothing. Too much mud. He walked toward the driver's side door, and then paused, looking at the car as a whole, frowning. Was it a Ford or a Chevy? Darned if he could tell, and that was strange because he had to have insured thousands of station wagons in his career.
Customized? He asked himself. Well, maybe, but who would bother to customize a station wagon into something so anonymous? Hi, hello. Everything okay? He walked toward the door, squeezing the phone a little tighter without being aware of it. He found himself thinking of some movie that had scared the heck out of him as a kid, some haunted house thing. A bunch of teenagers had approached the old deserted house, and when one of them saw the door standing ajar, he'd whispered, "Look, it's open," to his buddies. You wanted to tell them not to go in there, but of course they had. That's stupid. If there's someone in that car, he could be hurt. Of course, the guy might have gone up to the restaurant, might be looking for a payphone, but if he was really hurt. Hello? Doug reached for the door handle, then thought better of it and stooped to peer through the opening. What he saw was dismaying. The bench seat was covered with mud. So were the dashboard and steering wheel. Dark goo dripped from the old-fashioned knobs of the radio, and on the wheel were prints that didn't look exactly as if hands had made them. The palm prints were awfully big, for one thing, but the finger marks were as narrow as pencils. Is someone in there? He shifted his cell phone to his right hand and took hold of the driver's door with his left, meaning to swing it wide so he could look into the back seat. Is someone hurt? There was a moment to register an ungodly stink, and then his left hand exploded into pain so great it seemed to leap through his entire body, trailing fire and filling all his hollow spaces with agony. Doug couldn't scream. His throat locked shut with the sudden shock of it. He looked down and saw that the door handle appeared to have impaled the pad of his palm. His fingers were barely there. He could see only the stubs of them, just below the last knuckles where the back of his hand started. The rest had somehow been swallowed by the door. As Doug watched, the third finger broke. His wedding ring fell off and clinked to the pavement. He could feel something. Oh, dear God and dear Jesus. Something like teeth. They were chewing. The car was eating his hand. Doug tried to pull back. Blood flew, some against the muddy door, some splattering his slacks. The drops that hit the door disappeared immediately, with a faint, sucking sound. Slurp. For a moment, he almost got away. He could see glistening finger bones from which the flesh had been sucked, and he had a brief, nightmarish image of chewing on one of the colonel's chicken wings. Get it all before you put that down, his mother used to say. The meat's sweetest closest to the bone. Then he was yanked forward again. The driver's door opened to welcome him. Hello, Doug. Come on in. His head connected with the top of the door, and he felt a line of coldness across his brow that turned hot as the station wagon's roofline sliced through his skin. He made one more effort to get away, dropping his cell phone and pushing at the rear window. The window yielded, instead of supporting, then enveloped his hand. He rolled his eyes and saw what had looked like glass now rippling like a pond in a breeze. And why was it rippling? Because it was chewing. Because it was chowing down. This is what I get for being a good simp. Then the top of the driver's door sawed through his skull and slipped smoothly into the brain behind it. Doug Clayton heard a large, bright snap like a pine knot exploding in a hot fire. Then darkness descended. A southbound delivery driver glanced over and saw a little green car with its flashers on parked behind a mud-coated station wagon. A man, presumably he belonged to the little green car, appeared to be leaning in the station wagon's door talking to the driver. Breakdown, the delivery driver thought, and returned his attention to the road. No good Samaritan, he. Doug Clayton was jerked inside as if hands, ones with big palms and pencil-thin fingers, had seized his shirt and pulled him. The station wagon lost its shape and puckered inward, like a mouth tasting something exceptionally sour or exceptionally sweet.
From within came a series of overlapping crunches, the sound of a man stamping through dead branches in heavy boots. The wagon stayed puckered for 10 seconds or so. Looked more like a lumpy, clenched fist than a car. Then, with a puck sound, like a tennis ball being smartly struck by a racket, it popped back into its station wagon shape. The sun peeked briefly through the clouds, reflecting off the dropped cell phone and making a brief, hot circle of light on Doug's wedding ring. Then it dived back into the cloud cover. Behind the wagon, the Prius blinked its four ways. They made a low, clock-like sound. Tick. 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 A few cars went past, but not many. The work weeks surrounding Easter are the slowest time of year on the nation's turnpikes, and afternoon is the second slowest time of the day. Only the hours between midnight and 5 a.m. are slower. Tick. 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 In the abandoned restaurant, Pete Simmons slept on. 3. Julianne Vernon, 05 Dodge Ram. Julie Vernon didn't need King James to teach her how to be a good Samaritan. She had grown up in the small town of Reedfield, Maine, population 2,400, where neighboring was a way of life, and strangers were also neighbors. Nobody had told her this in so many words. She had learned from her mother, father, and big brothers. They had little to say about such issues, but teaching by example is always the most powerful teaching of all. If you saw a guy lying by the side of the road, it didn't matter if he was a Samaritan or a Martian. You stopped to help. Nor had she ever worried much about being robbed, raped, or murdered by someone who was only pretending to need help. Julie was the sort of woman who would supposedly make a good wife because, in the parlance of old Maine Yankees, of whom there are still a few, she'll give you warmth in the winter and shade in the summer. When asked for her weight by the school nurse when she was in the fifth grade, Julie had replied, proudly, "My dad says I dress out around 170, little less if skinned." Now at 35, she would have dressed out closer to 280 and had no interest in making any man a good wife. She was as gay as old dad's hat band and proud of it. On the back of her Ram truck were two bumper stickers. One read, "Support gender equality." The other, a bright pink, opined that gay is a happy word. The stickers didn't show now because she was hauling what she referred to as the Haas trailer. She had bought a 2-year-old Spanish jennet mare in the town of Clinton and was now on her way back to Reedfield, where she lived on a farm with her partner, just 2 miles down the road from the house where she'd grown up. She was thinking, as she often did, of her 5 years of touring with the Twinkles, a female mud wrestling team. Those years had been both bad and good. Bad because the Twinkles were generally regarded as freak show entertainment, which she supposed they sort of were. Good because she had seen so much of the world. Mostly the American world, it was true, but the Twinkles had once spent 3 months in England, France, and Germany, where they had been treated with a kindness and respect that was almost eerie. Like young ladies, in other words. She still had her passport and had renewed it last year, although she guessed she might never go abroad again. Mostly that was all right. Mostly she was happy on the farm with Amelia and their motley menagerie of livestock, but she sometimes missed those days of touring. The one-night stands, the matches under the lights, the rough camaraderie of the other girls. Sometimes she even missed the push and bump with the audience. "Grab her by the cunt, she's a dyke, she likes that," some shit-brained yokel had yelled one night in Tulsa, that had been, if she remembered right. She and Melissa, the girl she'd been grappling with in the mud bowl, had looked at each other, nodded to each other, and stood up facing the section of the audience from which the yell had come. They stood there, wearing nothing but their sopping bikini briefs, mud dripping from their hair and breasts, and had flipped the bird at the heckler in unison. The audience had broken into spontaneous applause, which became a standing O when first Julianne, then Melissa, turned, bent, dropped trow, and shot the asshole a double moon. She had grown up knowing you cared for the one who had fallen and couldn't get up. She had also grown up knowing that you ate no shit, not about your hosses, your size, your line of work, or your sexual preferences. Once you started eating shit, it had a way of becoming your regular diet. The CD she was listening to came to an end, and she was just about to poke the eject button when she saw a car ahead, parked a little way up the ramp leading to the abandoned Mile 81 service stop. Its four-way flashers were on. There was another car in front of it, a muddy old beat-to-shit station wagon, probably a Ford or a Chevrolet, it was hard to tell which. Julie didn't make a decision, because there was no decision to be made. She flipped her blinker, saw there would be no room for her on the ramp, not with the trailer in tow, and got as far over in the breakdown lane as she could without hooking her wheels in the soft ground beyond. The last thing she wanted to do was overturn the horse for which she had just paid $1,800. This was probably nothing, but it didn't hurt to check. You could never tell when some woman had all at once decided to have herself a baby on the interstate, or when some guy who stopped to help got excited and fainted. Julie put on her own four ways, but they wouldn't show much, not with the hoss trailer in the way. She got out, looked toward the two cars, and saw not a soul. Maybe someone had picked the drivers up, but more likely they'd gone up to the restaurant. Julie doubted if they'd find much there. It had been closed down since the previous September. Julie herself had often stopped at Mile 81 for a TCBY cone, but these days made her snack stop 20 miles north at Damon's in Augusta. She went around to the trailer, and her new horse, Dee Dee by name, poked her nose out. Julie stroked it. "Sue, baby. Sue. This'll just take a minute." She opened the door so she could get at the locker built into the trailer's left side. Dee Dee decided this would be a fine time to exit the vehicle, but Julie restrained her with one beefy shoulder, once again murmuring, "Sue, baby, Sue." She unlatched the locker. Inside, sitting on top of the tools, were a few road flares and two fluorescent pink mini traffic cones. Julie hooked her fingers into the hollow tops of the cones. No need for flares on an afternoon that was slowly beginning to brighten. She closed the locker and latched it, not wanting Dee Dee to step a hoof in and maybe hurt herself. Then she closed the back doors. Dee Dee once more poked her head out. Julie didn't really believe a horse could look anxious, but Dee Dee sort of did. "Not long," she said. Then placed the traffic cones behind the trailer and headed for the two cars. The Prius was empty but unlocked. Julie didn't particularly care for that, given the fact there was a suitcase and a fairly expensive-looking briefcase in the back seat. The driver's door of the old station wagon was hanging open. Julie started towards it, then stopped, frowning. Lying on the pavement beside the open door was a cell phone and what just about had to be a wedding ring. There was a big crack zigzagging up the phone's casing as if it had been dropped. And on the little glass window where the numbers appeared, was that a drop of blood? Probably not, probably just mud. The wagon was covered with it, but Julie liked this less and less. She had taken Dee Dee for a good canter before loading her and hadn't changed out of her no-nonsense split riding skirt for the trip home. Now she took her own cell phone out of the right-hand pocket and debated punching in 911. No, she decided. Not yet. But if the mud-splattered wagon was as empty as the little green car, or if that dime-sized spot on the dropped cell phone really was blood, she'd do it, and wait right here for the state police cruiser to come instead of walking up to that deserted building. She was brave, and she was kind-hearted, but she was not stupid. She bent to examine the ring and the dropped phone. The slight flare of her riding skirt brushed against the muddy flank of the station wagon and appeared to melt into it. Julie was jerked to the right, and hard. One hefty buttock slammed against the side of the wagon. The surface yielded, then enveloped two layers of cloth and the meat beneath. The pain was immediate and enormous. She screamed, dropped her phone, and tried to shove herself away, almost as if the car were one of her old mud-wrestling opponents. Her right hand and forearm disappeared through the yielding membrane that looked like a window. What appeared on the other side, vaguely visible through the scrim of mud, wasn't the hefty arm of a large and healthy horsewoman. but a starving bone with flesh hanging from it in tatters. The station wagon began to pucker. A car passed, southbound. Then another. Thanks to the trailer, they didn't see the woman who was now half in and half out of the deformed station wagon, like Br'er Rabbit stuck in the tar baby. Nor did they hear her screams. One driver was listening to Toby Keith, the other to Led Zeppelin. Both had his particular brand of music turned up loud. In the restaurant, Pete Simmons heard her, but only from a great distance, like a fading echo. His eyelids fluttered, then the screams stopped. Pete rolled over on the filthy mattress and went back to sleep. The thing that looked like a car ate Julianne Vernon, clothes, boots, and all. The only thing it missed was her phone, which now lay beside Doug Clayton's. Then it popped back into its station wagon shape with the same racket-hitting ball sound. In the Haas trailer, Dee Dee nickered and stamped an impatient foot. She was hungry. 4. The Lucier Family, 11 Expedition. 6-year-old Rachel Lucier shouted, "Look, Mommy, look, Daddy. It's the horse lady. See her trailer? See it?" Carla wasn't surprised Rach was the first to spot the trailer, even though she was sitting in the back seat. Rach had the sharpest eyes in the family. No one else even came close. X-ray vision, her father sometimes said. It was one of those jokes that isn't quite a joke. Johnny, Carla, and 4-year-old Blake all wore glasses. Everyone on both sides of the family wore glasses. Even Bingo, the family dog, probably needed them. Bing was apt to run into the screen door when he wanted to go out. Only Rach had escaped the curse of myopia. The last time she'd been to the optometrist, she'd read the whole damn eye chart bottom line, and Dr. Stratton had been amazed. She could qualify for jet fighter training, he told Johnny and Carla. Johnny said, maybe someday she will. She's certainly got a killer instinct when it comes to her little brother. Carla had thrown him an elbow for that, but it was true. She had heard there was less sibling rivalry when the Sibs were of different sexes. If so, Rachel and Blake were the exception that proved the rule. Carla sometimes thought the most common two words she heard these days were, started it. Only the gender of the pronoun opening the sentence varied. The two of them had been pretty good for the first 100 miles of this trip, partially because visiting with Johnny's parents always put them in a good mood, and mostly because Carla had been careful to fill up the no man's land between Rachel's booster seat and Blake's car seat with toys and coloring books. But after their snack and pee stop in Augusta, the squabbling had begun again. Probably because of the ice cream cones. Giving kids sugar on a long car trip was like squirting gasoline on a campfire. Carla knew this, but you couldn't refuse them everything. In desperation, Carla had started a game of Plastic Fantastic, serving as judge and awarding points for lawn gnomes, wishing wells, statues of the Blessed Virgin, etc. The problem was the turnpike, where there were lots of trees but very few vulgar roadside displays. Her sharp-eyed 6-year-old daughter and her sharp-tongued 4-year-old boy were beginning to renew old grudges when Rachel saw the horse trailer pulled over just a little shy of the old Mile 81 rest stop. "Want to pet the horsey again?" Blake shouted. He began thrashing in his car seat, the world's smallest brake dancer. His legs were just long enough to kick the back of the driver's seat, which Johnny found Trey annoying. "Somebody tell me why I wanted to have kids," he thought. "Somebody remind me just what I was thinking. I know it made sense at the time." "Blakey, don't kick Daddy's seat," Johnny said. "Want to pet the horsey," Blake yelled, and fetched the back of the driver's seat an especially good one. "You are such a babykins," Rachel said, save from brother kicks on her side of the backseat DMZ. She spoke in her most indignant big girl tone, the one always guaranteed to infuriate Blakey. "I am ain't a babykins." "Blakey," Johnny began, "if you don't stop kicking Daddy's seat, Daddy will have to take his trusty butcher knife and amputate Blakey's little feetsies at the ank." "She's broken down," Carla said. "See the traffic cones? Pull over." "Hun, that'd be in the breakdown lane. Not such a good idea." "No, just swing around and park beside those other two cars, on the ramp. There's room and you won't be blocking anything because the rest area is closed. If it's okay with you, I'd like to get back to Falmouth before pull over. Carla heard herself using the DEFCON 1 tone that brooked no refusal, even though she knew it was a bad idea. How many times lately had she heard Rach using that exact same tone on Blake, using it until the little guy broke down in tears? Switching off the "she who must be obeyed" voice and speaking more softly, Carla said, "That woman was nice to the kids." They had pulled into Damon's next to the horse trailer when they stopped for ice cream. The horse lady, nearly as big as a horse herself, was leaning against the trailer, eating an ice cream cone of her own and feeding something to a very handsome beastie. To Carla, the treat looked like a Kashi granola bar. Johnny had one kid by each hand and tried to walk them past, but Blake was having none of that. "Can I pet your horse?" he asked. "Cost you a quarter," the big lady in the brown riding skirt had said, and then grinned at Blakey's crestfallen expression. "Nah, I'm only kidding. Here, hold this." She thrust her drippy ice cream cone at Blake, who was too surprised to do anything but take it. Then she lifted him up to where he could pet the horse's nose. Dee Dee regarded the wide-eyed child calmly, sniffed at the horse lady's dripping cone, decided it wasn't what she wanted, and allowed her nose to be stroked. "Whoa, soft," Blake said. Carla had never heard him speak with such simple awe. Why haven't we ever taken these kids to a petting zoo, she wondered, and immediately put it down on her mental to-do list. "Me, me, me," Rachel bugled, dancing around impatiently. The big lady set Blake down. "Lick that ice cream while I lift your sister," she told him. "But don't get cooties on it, okay?" Carla thought of telling Blake that eating after people, especially strange people, was not okay. Then she saw Johnny's bemused grin and thought, what the hell? You sent your kids to schools that were basically germ factories. You drove them for hundreds of miles on the turnpike where any drunk maniac or texting teenager could cross the median strip and wipe them out. Then you forbade them to lick on a partially used ice cream? That was taking the car seat and bike helmet mentality a little too far, maybe. The horse lady lifted Rachel so Rachel could pet the horse's nose. "Wowie, nice," Rachel said. "What's her name?" "Dee Dee." "Great name."